It's time to think big with Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and No Good Lying Through Your Tooth to Alaska Tales. It's the Big Alaska Show. Broadcasting from the studios of a remote cabin outside Bolchitna and streamed worldwide at KFQD.com with podcasts streamed at BigAlaskaShow.com. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Stevenson, Big Alaska Show friends. The bears are waking up, and time for the Big Alaska Show Bear Story Special, featuring assistant to the Commissioner of Fish and Game, Rick Rydell Green. And a classic gold medal bear attack story with Gene Moe. Plus a rotary update with Mike Ferris. Designed to raise your spirits and not your blood pressure, unless you're a guy named Mike Ford. Good morning, everyone. It's the Big Alaska Show.
And good morning, and thank you for joining us on the Big Alaska Show. I'm here with my good buddy, co-host Mike Ford. I'm Uncle Steve, and you know, it's bear season.
Yes.
And the bears are coming out of torpor.
Oh, they've already done that. They have been around.
Have they really?
Yes, indeed. A couple of people I've talked to have already seen them up on the hillside, wandering here and there.
Okay, then our show's perfect timing. So
yes.
And they don't hibernate. It's called torpor, which really messes us up, because hibernation's torpor. Torpor sounds like
a Swedish dessert.
Yeah, we have torpor.
Torpor.
And the thing that I really enjoyed about this particular show when we did this with Rick is we discussed one of our favorite topics. Do you remember what that was?
I do. It made me think of New Year's Eve when people are popping the champagne corks.
Blowing the plug?
Yes.
You know, I wonder when bears blow the plug, if they don't say something like, got a cigarette? I need to discuss blowing the plug with Gordon.
Oh, that'd be a good hour and a half explanation, I would imagine.
Yeah, right. Yes. Anyway, so we got Rick Rydell. We're going to talk about bears coming out of torpor, or we call it hibernation. And then we've got this remarkable story. I'm so glad we have this, of Gene Moe, who at the age of 68 encountered a Kodiak grizzly and went hand-to-hand combat for about 45 minutes and survived. And so we have that interview with him. And sadly, Gene passed away a few months ago. So I'm really glad we have this interview with Gene.
So he must have been in his 90s, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Minnesota boy. And in fact, I've been meeting people from Minnesota. And so I told them we're going to do this show eventually. So I want to make sure that we say a big howdy-do to our friends out of Minnesota. That's where Gene Moe.
You know, every time something dumb happens to me, like I stub my toe or I smash my thumb with a hammer or something along those lines, I reminisce about the story that Gene Moe is going to be sharing today, because it's like, that ain't nothing compared to what this dude went through. You know what I mean?
Although you have to admit that when you stub your toe, for that moment, you're not thinking of Gene Moe.
No, that's true. But I try to think about him as soon as I can right after, though.
Yeah, so. Finally, when the smoke clears, you can do. Anyway, we've got a fun show with Gene Moe and Rick Rydell Green, and it all has to do with the theme of bears. But of course, Mike, we'd be remiss if we didn't start the Big Alaska out the right way. Folks, the trick to doing a radio show, especially an early Saturday morning radio show, is a strong cup of coffee. And there's no stronger cup of Joe than Big Alaska Show Blend, the intense early morning coffee for intense early morning indigestion. The secret lies in a patented basaltic process, a process that involves a multi-headed diamond drill bit that scours the most remote mountainsides, remote mainly to avoid environmental liability lawsuits. And there, the fine basaltic dust is gathered, mixed into a thick caffeinated oil to make one of the most caustic cups of joe that delivers such a powerful pucker power punch, your buns will tighten and grasp a cue ball and crush it. Bitter biting with a specific gravity of basalt, Big Alaska Show blend, intense early morning coffee for intense early morning gas.
Pour me a cup, it's time to get up and face the world, my friend. Pour me a cup, I can't get enough of that Big Alaska Show blend.
And that's how we roll here at the Big Alaska Show. But stick around, we have more Big Alaska Show coming up. And you can hear our show streamed and get podcasts at bigalaskashow.com. Hi, this is Uncle Steve for the Big Alaska Show. We call our show the Big Alaska Show because, well, everything's big in Alaska. The state's big, the mountains, the glaciers, the rivers and streams, the wildlife, all of them big. But to me, the biggest thing about Alaska are Alaskans, whose spirit and stories make this place special. You're about to hear a tale of Gene Moe. In 1998, at the age of 68, Gene was hunting in Kodiak when he was attacked by a Kodiak grizzly. Gene went hand-to-hand combat with a bear with only a small buck knife to defend himself. That, an Alaskan spirit that was bigger than Alaska's outdoors. What is your name?
Gene Moe.
Gene Moe. Now, how long have you been in Alaska?
1948.
Now, where did you come up from?
Minnesota.
Why, was it warmer here?
Well, I had a chance to go for a scholarship for basketball, and I had a chance to go down into Kansas, and I would do that if I could take my traps along and do a little trapping in the wintertime. And I got a picture of Kansas, and there wasn't a single tree there. The next day, I'm 17, the next day I head for Alaska.
Now, what position did you play in basketball?
Well, I was an end in football and a forward in basketball. It was during part of the Depression, but the schools were so good that they always traveled someplace so we could play basketball and play football. They did very good for the times, as tough as they were, and I'm so thankful that I had a chance to do that in life.
Kansas wasn't the place that you could do traps and stuff.
No,
like that.
Well, there was no trees there. I couldn't even find a river there. So I gave that up real fast because I've been reading books on Alaska ever since I could read, and that's what I wanted to do. And so that's how I headed to Alaska.
So you read something about Alaska, and that got you excited about coming up here.
Well, you have them old stories like Yellow Fang or White Fang or the different hunting stories or the prospectors, and it was just something new I wanted to do because my life is in the woods.
So you grew up being an outdoorsman.
Yeah, we trapped ever since I was 7 years old. I had my own trap line, and then I could buy clothes with the furs that we got, and so my mother trapped a little bit, my dad trapped, and my brothers trapped. We all had trap lines, and that was a way of making some money, and fur prices were pretty good being Depression time. They held up. The fur prices were pretty fair.
Let's talk about what happened in Kodiak. You went to hunting in Kodiak.
Yes, it was the 1st of November in 1999. There was four of us there. My boy was one. It was a beautiful morning. It's real before daylight, but with the snow on top of the mountain, on the water, we went by lots of geese and ducks and a lot of fur seal. They are very tame. They lay upside down. They're the animal that lays on its back and always brings a rock up to break up a crab shell or some very interesting animal. And we go down there, and I'm going to take this one guy with me. He hasn't got a deer yet, and so he's going to walk with me and my boy, and another one went another way. And we had a poor morning in hunting. The wind was kind of a squirrely thing, and he had a hard time to really listen what to do, but it was a fine fellow, but he just didn't want to listen. And that morning he had a chance on two deer, but didn't get them. And We stopped at noon and had lunch and started down the canyon on the other side. And I'd send him down on a trail along a canyon, and I'd swing out and I was going to drive deer back to him. Well, I'd seen three of them on the first one come by, and I got up back up to him, and he had pulled his ear flappers down. And I said, "Steve, you can't hear when you got your ears up." Well, he says, "I can hear all right." Well, he didn't hear the deer, and it's got to be 2 o'clock, and I wanted to bring one back out to the boat. I swung out the next time, and there was a deer there, and I shot it. We had a deal. If I shoot, you come to the noise, and if you shoot, I'll come to your noise. He didn't come, and then we had an old thing we used to do, my brother and I in Minnesota. We would talk like an owl. We'd hoot like an owl, and the animals never were spooked, but we could communicate. Well, I hooted, he didn't come, and he didn't come. So I have to butcher this deer out. We only 4:30, we got to be on the beach. It's dark. What we do with a deer there, we butcher and take all the meat off the animal, put it on the pack board, and then we can walk out with it instead of dragging the whole deer. And I've been making good time. It took me about 45 minutes. I have everything, the meat laying on a piece of plastic, and I opened up and got the liver and the heart. We usually have that before supper at night in our camp. We fry the liver and the heart, and that's, we tell stories what we seen that day. Well, I had the liver and heart, and I'm in big woods, and I usually drag a deer out into the open where I can see around it in case a bear did come or something. But this was all big timber, virgin timber. So I had the liver in my left hand, I had my knife in the right hand, and all at once a bear about 30 feet come growling and coming at me in full speed. So I threw the liver and heart to the plastic, and I remember saying this, "Lord, please help me, I need help." And about that time, the bear was right to me, and my idea was to put the knife down the bear's throat. Bear had his mouth open, and I went right alongside of his mouth and cut part of his side of his hide alongside of it, but I missed his mouth, and he grabbed me right by the shoulder, right by the elbow there, and that was an awful bad feeling, really, that he could pull the meat away from the bone, and I thought probably he'd taken my arm off, and his head was right up against mine. So I got the arm opened, and I reached around the head, and my idea was to get my finger in the bear's eye. I came to the ear, and I pushed my finger way up in that ear and twisted it, and you know what? That bear didn't like that. He growled and pulled away from me, and he went about 12, 15 feet or a little bit farther. He turned around, and if you look at a bear, they've got the most ugly eyes. They got eyes like a pig. They just kind of stare at you. And this time he come again. Now, I learned something 52 years before when I was up above Anchorage and up on the mountain there studying about bear. I believe myself that a bear are right pawed, like 90% of the human are right pawed. Now, I've watched bear, they'll jump in the water with both front feet to grab a salmon, but if they're picking berries, all the time they'll push with their left foot and lean on the right paw and his mouth they bring the berries into. So I always see predominantly. And I had remembered that. So when that bear came at me, his right paw is down low, going up and down. So I didn't really watch the bear, but I watched that right paw. When it came, I pulled my head back. The one claw got me in the face and cut my ear in two. And then he hit me and knocked me down. And I had big, heavy boots on, and my legs were right up against my back when he come to land on me. I kicked out as hard as I could, and I kicked that bear just below the head in the neck, and he flew off sideways, and actually I got up before the bear got up, and this time he walked again away, and he stood and looked at me, and this time he came, and I knew I had to get inside of him because he tore me up real bad with the other paw on my legs and through my butt there. This time, When he come, I waved my right foot. I was thinking if I could get him to look that way. I looked down on my right arm, and there the knife was still in that hand. And so he came diving for my right leg. And when he got there, I put my arm over his neck, and the right paw came over but couldn't hit me. I got in and close on top, and I took that knife and I jabbed it in his neck, and I pulled it out and I jabbed it. When I got in under by his jaw, I cut a big hole in him, and I just dug it back and forth, and he had a hard time pulling off with only one paw behind me. And when he pulled back, I hit him again with the knife up in the neck, and I must have hit a vertebrae, because his neck flew and head flew right towards me and just covered me with blood. So I may have got the jugular vein, I didn't know. But he then pulled away and he went off our little arena where we've been fighting. And then he went in the brush and he came back again. This time his head is cocked real to the right and the blood is coming out of him. And I'm pretty well spent, and I see the bear is pretty well spent, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I says, come on, I says, the Lord's on my side. And he made a futile jump, and he had his paws in, and when I hit him with my left paw, and I hit, my left fist hit him right below the eye into the nose. Now, if you know a dog, you can take a 12-inch pencil and hit a dog on the nose and they'll cry. They can't take that. And the bear, I didn't know, but the same thing. I hit that bear so hard he stood right in midair for a while, and when he fell down, the only thing ever moved on him was his head fell into the moss. So I looked at that bear and I wondered if he's dead. Now usually if I shoot an animal, if I hit the brain or the neck or the backbone, they're dead instantly, right there. But I didn't know if I knocked him out or if it. So I tried to go back to get the gun. Well, the gun was back about 10 feet back, but my right hand is all turned white where I hit that bear, and the right hand wouldn't move. My left hand wouldn't move. My right hand was bad, but I got I had a shell in the gun, and I couldn't hold the gun with the left, but I put my arm out and leaned, and I shot that bear right in the chest. Never nothing. I seen some hair move, but nothing. So then I got the gun to put another shell in, and the meat that's off my right, that's down on the wrist, gets on top of my breech of my gun, so I have to bring the gun up, and I had a hard time getting another shell in, but I shot him again. Still nothing moved, just the hair. And I remember putting the gun down, and I'm going to walk back. I tell myself, I'm going to walk back and kick that bear. And I had a hard time to walk because where he bit me in the leg, all of my meat was over my knee laying down below. And so I had trouble to get there. But when I got, I just looked up and I says, thank you, Lord. And so I laid down. The bear's laying there, and I laid there. And I said, well, they'll probably find us or something. I laid for a long time, and I said, you know, I may can get out of this thing yet. I may get out. I got up, which was hard to get up. My stuff was coming back. My feeling was coming back in my left hand. The right hand was bleeding pretty heavily through there. And I said, I'm going to try to come out of here. I had some plastic bags in my pack board, and I took the plastic bag and I wrapped it around that meat on my right arm, and I wrapped it and wrapped it. Now my leg, it was bleeding real much, and it was below the knee. It bit me above the knee, and I wrapped a plastic around there, and I had pulled my knife out when I come there because I couldn't get the knife out of my hand before I shot, so I had to put it up in my teeth, pulled my fingers back on my right hand, so the knife fell there, and the knife was there. So I put the knife back in my pocket, and I started down, and that's probably the toughest thing I've ever done. I got into some alders, and if you ever walked in alders in Alaska, that is a hard thing, and that tore the plastic off, and I was thinking to cut the meat off, and I was very fortunate I didn't, but I got off them alders, and I remember laying down two times, and I had a hard time getting up, and everything got dizzy, but I took my left arm, and I pushed some snow up, and I eat some snow, and the dizziness went around, and when I got down finally to the beach down there, and I walked around the beach, and I couldn't go any farther, but I knew I was close to where the boat is, because when I ever go into Alaska, I got a mountain or something behind me. I always look to the back where I'm going in at, so when I come out, I can always line up on this certain mountain peak or something. So I said, "Boy, I'm right on here." So I was, when I got within about 200-300 yards of the boat, everything started going around. It was a big flat rock, and I yelled, and Steve was down there, and the other hunter was there. And they heard me, and they come running. And I remember telling Steve, the other one, I says, "Please just take a gun and shoot me." "Well," he says, "I'll tell you what, if you're here in the morning, I'll shoot you." So anyhow, then we have a deal. When it gets to be 4 o'clock, we always shoot who's on the shore where the boat is, and the person in the woods or up there, they answer with a rifle, so no, it's time to come on. Well, but Tom, he shot, and my boy, I could hear him up on the mountain yet, he shot, and so he came down, and what happened? They were yelling for him to come sooner because I'd been tore up with a bear, so he understood there was a bear between us, so he didn't want to go down right away, and he had a deer on his back too, so... We finally got down to it, and my boy never looked at me at all. I laid in the bottom of that boat, and we pushed out, and the water, wind had come up, so it was about 3-foot waves, and that one motor wasn't taking that boat, and he tried the other motor, and it started the full first pull, and we went up in where that German couple lived there, and we got out of the wind when we got up that bay, and when we got there, it... they yelled, and there was three guys that came out of there. Well, they tried to carry me, and that hurt worse than anything. So I said, "Just leave me, and I can make it." And so I remember going around this man's house. It went around the west side and the north side. He had a little porch on the back, and I went through that. I laid down on his living room. What he had there was just plywood. They had just been building their house the last year. We had never went to these German thing because some fishermen said that they weren't good people. So for the last 10 years, we'd never talked to them, whoever went there. But you know, they were the most gracious people I've ever met. She went and got 2 sleeping bags. They wanted to see if they could wrap my arm and my leg up. And she had some ACE bandage, and I've done this in construction of all of our years. I always make all of our men go through first aid. And so Tom put my arm together, that meat there, and I remember him laying there, and he pushes the thumb in. A lot of tendons were shredded and stuff, and he tried to line them up, and he wrapped them, and then he'd poke some. Didn't want to touch me at first. I says, "Carl, you got to help." And so he took the woman's... apron and cut it in 8-inch strips, and he took the meat that laid below my knee and he put back up in there, and he wrapped that them apron rips over my leg. And this German did something that nobody would ever do. He took a chainsaw and cut 2 studs off the house and cut the plywood out and called on his radio phone, and we happened to get a Coast Guard helicopter just going out the ground. It was about 5:30 at night, and they were going on night maneuvers. So they swung, and they only had about 50, 60 miles. So they were there in a short time, landed there, put the stretcher through the hole in the wall, and I got in the stretcher. My boy wanted to go with me, and I said, "Carl, you better stay, because we're responsible to get that hide off that bear, because it ain't bear season." And so he did, and I got on there, and a short trip in there, and the ambulance come there. I remember going in and out of consciousness, and that man standing on his knees behind me kept shaking me, "You're not going no place." He didn't let me ever go under. And so he did that. And I remember in the ambulance, they put tubes in me and one thing and another. And we went to a hospital, and it's a brand new hospital down there, a 23-bed hospital. I didn't know that was just built. And so I met a doctor there, and he was worked with me 12 hours that night. He sewed over 7 hours, it's sewing up. And I asked him later how many stitches. Well, he said, we quit at 500. That was just below your hips. And so he never opened up my right arm at all. Everything was good. My wife came down the next day, and I was only there about 8 days, and I never got one bit of infection. I was treated so good.
I remember hearing a song about Davy Crockett killing a bear when he was only 3. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know this. Gene Moe, at 68 years of age, did fight a Kodiak grizzly by hand and won. And that was only 1 in 10 bear encounters Gene would have. We'll save those stories for another time. In the meantime, welcome to the Big Alaska Show.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Is that...
We did that interview over 10 years ago.
Wow.
That's Gene Moe, who was attacked by a Kodiak bear, as you've heard, and this story is remarkable. The knife he used was created by Buck, the company. It was a Buck knife. And when I went and did the interview at his house on this, it's in a glass case and still has the bear fur on it. And it's not a big knife.
No.
What amazes me most about, well, there's a couple of things about the story that I find incredible. First of all, it makes me feel wimpy. It's just when I get up in the morning and I've got aches and pains at 5 in the morning, I am never going to be complaining again. Because this guy,
the way he describes the meat on my leg was laying, you know, his thigh meat lays over his knee, and they pull it back up and they tie it together.
Yeah. Think about this for a couple of minutes. Having the presence of mind to tell his son, no, you better hang out. We don't want the fish and game people to be ticked off about the bear hide. I'm like, yeah, that would be right on the top of my list of things to deal with, right?
His matter of factness. I mean, you know, it's really interesting to hear it again because I hear it with all new fresh ears.
Yeah. Descriptive stuff about like having the mountain to his back. If you've ever gone through alderwood, and that takes me back to when I'm a kid, because going through alders is tough. Just thinking about that and the boat, and having grown up around water and gone around in little dinghies and things when I was a kid, and just knowing when an engine doesn't do what you need it to do because you got 3-foot waves and a wind, a headwind, it's like, oh my God. And then, and he's remembering all this, right? I mean, how is this guy not passing out from loss of blood and everything? It's just amazing.
How far he had to walk. The way he described it reminds me of the movie Fargo.
Yeah.
And end of story. You know, what's your name? Gene Moe. You know, I mean, it's real.
And the two other facts that caught me, or that made me really think about how fortunate and the timing of it. The helicopter was just heading out on maneuvers, and the hospital had just been finished. And think about that, two factors right there. Can't even imagine that.
And his description of it was a 23-room hospital, or 23-bed. Gene Moe's not a small guy either. I mean, he's probably about 6'4", but still, and he was a Mason, so he was a strong man, obviously. But 68, anybody taking on a grizzly like that.
And that was his first bear encounter. Now, if that was happening to you, would you be back out where the bears are anymore?
Like they say, a cat won't get back on a hot stove, but it won't get back on a cold one either.
You know, this is the kind of guys that built Alaska. Even the way he was, he was a swell fellow, but he really didn't know what he was doing, and he had his ear flaps down. I'm like, why would you take a yahoo like that out in the wilderness? You know, I would have put his butt in the boat and said, hang out, have a sandwich and watch the view. We're going to get things done and get out of here, you know?
It's a fantastic, one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard.
Yeah, I'm glad you found that one again. That was great.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Alaska Enterprise Solutions. They're your authorized sales agent for Xerox in Alaska. Call Mike Ferris or visit him anytime at aesalaska.com.
And thanks for joining us at the Big Alaska Show. I'm Uncle Steve, along with co-host Mike Ford. Well, the bears are coming out of hibernation, and who better than to talk to our good buddy from the Alaska Fishing Game, Rick Rydell, to tell us about them.
Let's talk about bears. Rick, you're a hunter. You're a, you know, you've got a lot of experience. Bears are coming out of hibernation.
Yeah, they're out of hibernation now, and they're looking to start fattening up for the summer. That goes at kind of a slow pace until about September, October, and then bears enter a thing called hyperphagia, which is their metabolism kicking in, saying you've got to start eating the calories for the winter. And then things get a little more tense because they're a little more aggressive. But this is the start. And, of course, black bears are a little safer than brown bears in some ways. And in some ways, they're a little more dangerous than brown bears. And we have both in Anchorage.
I was wondering, do you know approximately how many bears we have estimated in the Anchorage area?
Yeah, there's 250 to 300 black bears, and there's 50 to 60 brown bears. With the extreme scientific modeling that we use, we can tell you that.
In fact, that's something I've always wondered, Mike Ford, is how they count the size of the fish counts they get there in the millions, or how many bears you've counted. Do they actually have somebody who goes out there and goes, no, that's one. That's a, no, that you just counted that one. Okay.
Right.
There's, well, with planes involved in some regard, wouldn't there
well,
be?
In some animals, yes, planes are involved. In some animals, hair traps are involved. In some animals, in fish particular, some of the most intricate sonar in the world is involved. And sometimes we're just guessing.
So this could be just a bold-faced lie that you...
Well, you know, for bears in particular, because, you know, bears are dark animals and they live in the dark woods. How do you do that? You can't really fly over and say, oh, there's a bear. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a bear. Mm-hmm. Oh, that no, that's not a bear. Yeah, that's a bear. And to do like hair traps, it's a little hard with all the people in the area. So what they ended up doing is we've got a large board on a wall with a bunch of numbers, and we throw a dart. that's not actually true.
I was falling for it.
You were going there. Yeah. No, what there is it's really hard to count. So what they've done, and it's been a while since we've actually checked to see if this worked, but many years ago, we did a habitat study. And, you know, we have different habitats throughout Anchorage. And so they do a habitat study, and then they apply those numbers to similar habitats. And those can be extrapolated statewide.
How is this going to affect the bear population? There's not as much hunting going to go on this year, I'm taking it.
There's not as much non-resident hunting, but the resident hunters are still out. I was just out 2 weeks ago, actually, looking for down at Bird Creek. But so resident hunting, which for urban bears or ones closer to town, is probably more the norm for residents. Non-residents usually go further out.
But how do you determine what's a healthy population? How does that work? And does that tie in with the moose we have in town as well?
Yeah, well, you know, the moose are, it's kind of an interesting scenario because in town, the moose, and to, just to let you know, in the summertime, there's, you know, 300-400 moose in town. In the wintertime, there's 1,000 to 1,500 moose in town. And part of that is the habitat. I mean, everything with wildlife is habitat. And if a habitat is deep snow, the moose are vulnerable. So they're going to go where there's less snow and where there's less predators. There's a lot fewer predators in Anchorage than there are outside of Anchorage. So a lot of moose come to winter here. And the plowed roads help a lot too.
Mike Ferris has talked about the health of the fishing industry and how they determine that. How do they do that for wildlife? I mean, does that fall into your, is that part of the job you're involved in?
Yeah, it is actually. And what we have, each area has an area manager in wildlife. The division in our department that deals with wildlife, which is probably I hate to say this because some people in other divisions may hear this, but wildlife really is where my passion is. And each area manager has to keep track of the habitat they have, the amount of habitat, and then figure out the carrying capacity of that habitat. A good example of that would be the 40-mile caribou herd right now. The 40-mile caribou herd is a transboundary herd. So it goes through Alaska and then a little bit over into Canada. And we have an agreement with Canada on harvest, but we're not necessarily in agreement on what is the maximum carrying capacity of the habitat. We, on the Alaska side, think we're a little above the carrying capacity, and then they could eat their habitat out of food. So we'd like to see that number go down. If you imagine, caribou populations are very boom and bust. I mean, they grow really, really big, and then the habitat gets wiped out, and then they go way down. And that's normally what happens with a lot of wildlife. But when you're managing for sustained yield, you try and even that out a little bit. So there's not the big highs and there won't be the big lows. You try and keep them right before the breaking point. And with the 40-mile caribou, we had to do a special hunt this year and try and reduce the numbers to keep them at that carrying capacity. You sure I'm not geeking out too much on fishing game here?
No, I'm loving this.
Who knew with what's going on with the supermarkets and all of the different food that we get from outside now, you know, with our beef and all that going to be in short supply.
Yeah, see, I don't get a lot of that.
I know, right?
Yeah.
You know.
We had really nice moose tacos a couple nights ago.
But that's the thing. So with the, you know, disparity of the runs, especially on the Kenai for the fish, and, you know, it's not like we can all just go out and grab a moose that's out, you know, in Bicentennial Park and ride it home and put it in our freezer.
I want to correct you there because you can, you just can't get caught.
Okay, very good.
That's what I like about our state officials here.
You know, the harvesting, I would like to hear a little bit about the history of that part too. You know, if I know we're, that would be a diversion from bears to moose, but you know.
Well, yeah, but that's okay. I mean, because we got a lot of requests during this COVID thing to open up, especially in rural Alaska, special hunts outside the normal hunting seasons, and people wanted it for food. You know, and certainly we consider those things. But so what we first do is we go to Unified Command and we say, okay, is the supply chain for food broken in any of these places? And at this point, they've said, no, they're really not. And so at that point, we look to see if we had harvestable surpluses. And outside the normal hunting seasons, we don't. So we didn't authorize any. But, you know, if the supply chain breaks, that's food out there, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if I take an extra moose, you know, what does that do to the bears?
It depends, because we probably would not authorize a hunt where there was not a harvestable surplus. You know, there are certain areas, as I said, we try and manage for the carrying capacity of the habitat. And with that management, there is a certain percentage that is harvestable surplus, which won't damage the population. And that's usually what we provide in hunting opportunities.
When you're talking about rural, we hear about polar bears. What's the status of polar bears? You know, we see the melting and all this kind of thing.
Well, polar bears are managed by the feds. They're a marine mammal, so they're really not in our purview, although we do have some input into some of the modeling on it. And, you know, I saw the picture you're talking about, and I think what a lot of people forget is that in wildlife, like in domestic life, there are diseases and there's old age and sometimes things die. And when I saw the picture of that polar bear, I was thinking, okay, does it have cancer? Does it have something wrong with it? We want to assume that they're starving because we're being told that they are. But, you know, there's more polar bears now than there were 20 years ago. And they are protected by the federal government and by the CITES Act and a bunch of other things.
Overall, how healthy is the bear population statewide? I know that's a broad question, but it sounds like there are a lot of bears.
There are. There's a good, healthy amount of bears and a lot of opportunity for people who want to go hunt. I know my my kids, when I was guiding a lot, a lot of times out-of-state hunters didn't want to take their bear meat. And you know, my kids grew up eating black bear meat and sometimes brown bear if they weren't too old. What if I told you that the absolute best meat to complement the seasonings that make Italian sausage is actually a spring black bear? Best Italian sausage you've ever had.
But you're not saying that that meat makes the spices taste great.
I'm saying that the combination of the two, I mean, certain meats, certain wild games, and I eat most of them, including lynx, by the way, and we can talk about the hot cats I make. They're actually hot dogs, but they're made out of cats, so I call them hot cats. Certain meats complement certain spices better than others. A caribou or a blacktail probably make the best taco meat in the world with the taco spices. Black bear, I think, makes some of the best Italian sausage, and you can also make a really good chorizo with it.
Do you believe him, Ford?
I think it's a tall Alaska tale.
I do. That's amazing. As in your position, what's a major challenge you're dealing with? I know we have the pandemic, but what are some of the real major challenges you face in the position you've got, Rick?
You know, I'm really lucky because in our management system, in our fish, in our wildlife management, we are really directed by the Board of Fish and the Board of Game. They make the policies and they make the plans. Then our departments carries those plans out and we do the practice of them in the science. So the challenge really is probably reaching out to different user groups and explaining why we do what we do.
I can see that.
Yeah.
So let's take a real quick break, and I'd like to come back, and if you have a little time, Rick, tell us a couple of stories of your guiding experience. And I've got one of your books still that you autographed. It was with your kid.
That only brings the value down in half when I signed it.
Right. I know. Well, Mike, are you a hunter? Were you ever a hunter?
Nope. I got out and fished some, but never really had the opportunity to go out and be a hunter. How about you?
It broke my heart to hunt. I like taking pictures. And
you Bambi, didn't you?
I did. When I was a kid, I shot a deer. My dad was so excited, and I was just heartbroken. And a lot of people don't understand hunting. But Rick is the kind of guy, he's the quintessential Alaskan hunter who respects wildlife. What he shoots, he eats.
Yep.
Anyway, when we come back, we've got more with Rick Rydell here in the Big Alaska Show. We're talking to Rick Rydell with the Alaska Fish and Game about bears and coming out of hibernation, and this is part two of that interview. Mike, have you ever heard the term blowing the plug?
Well... Does it have to do with something about coming out of hibernation, Steve? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I heard it from Pat Noldy with Bass Pro, and it was very entertaining. Is that a term you know of, Rick?
Oddly enough, yes. And since it was on the questions I was going to get, I did tell a few of my coworkers, oh, my God, they've discovered the fecal plug.
Yeah.
Do you know how that starts? Do you know how that whole thing begins?
No. That's why I mean.
Yeah. So in the fall, right before they hibernate, the bears all go to Chipotle, and they.
Oh.
No, yeah, it's not quite that sexy, but.
Now, Rick, the reason they go to Chipotle is because they know that they don't rinse the beans.
Yeah, right. Which maybe is part of why this happens, but you know the real answer is yes, there is a fecal plug that gathers in the colon of the bear as the bear is involved in torpor, or as most people say, hibernating. Understand that the inside systems still work, maybe at a little bit reduced rate, but the final step of that system doesn't work. So all of the bodily fluids and dead cells and whatever else they collect right before they go into hibernation ends up down at the end of the colon, and it sits there and hardens and dries out until they wake up.
You know, I'm really surprised this hasn't been marketed as an aphrodisiac in some other country.
I wouldn't say it hasn't been. God knows.
I've heard it's tart, but not bitter.
So now
I use mine shaken, not stirred.
Yeah. So my understanding is the reason they do this is to retain the nutrients. Is that correct? I mean,
that's a rumor out there that I've heard. I don't know that I've heard or seen any science to back that up.
So anyway, so when they come out, it's time to clear the
time
pipes.
To clear, get the plumbing cleared out, right? and usually you can find the fecal plug. If you're somewhere near the den, it comes out relatively quickly. It's an inch and a half wide by it's an inch and a half to 2 inches wide, anywhere from 7 to 14 inches long. And it's a very dense, odorless plug.
Okay. Now I'm curious, was it you or one of your staff that actually had to measure that?
My staff and many others that deal with bears all over the place. Yeah, we study this stuff. Like I said, the conversations are very interesting if you're a biology geek.
But I wonder if I
do you really wonder anything after that?
Yeah, right. Mike and I have this, Gordon Snyder, our science guy, likes us because we have this sixth grain mentality. And so they blow the plug, and I'm sure I can only imagine. I bet they all go, oh, man.
Well, it stands to reason, the fact that Rick knows the dimensions of this thing, that it's probably been dissected and researched to see what kind of is going on with the environment that these bears are habitating.
And oddly enough, I can tell you, and this is back to one of those conversations, one of the things they do in the latter part of hibernation, or torpor as they're in, is sometimes they chew the dead parts of their foot pads off, and parts of that are found in the plug.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd wondered if they can study that for, you know, nutrients and the health of the bear, and I mean, if there's a possibility on that.
Oddly enough, if you type in fecal plug Wikipedia, I think there's a listing.
We ran out of time, but to hear Rick Rydell Green's full interview, catch it on our podcast at BigAlaskaShow.com. So, that's our show. Nature has a way of letting us know who's in charge. But I gotta say, Gene Moe's hand-to-hand combat with a Kodiak grizzly bear, and then being able to walk out of it, and not just walk out of it, but nonchalantly walk out of it, is what legends are made from. I'm just glad I was able to hear it firsthand from Gene. And to my baby girl, love you, and Mike Ford, why don't you take us out as you so eloquently do?
All right, Uncle Steve, we want to thank Rick and Mike for joining us. We want to thank you for listening, and we want to thank our sponsors, Neighbors Windows and Doors, Alaska's window experts at 6251 Tuttle, or online at neighborswindowsanddoors.com. And Alaska Enterprise Solutions, your authorized Xerox sales agent for Alaska. Visit them anytime at aesalaska.com. Remember, if it's Big Alaska Guests, Big Alaska Adventures, and no good line three or two tall Alaska tales, it's gotta be the Big Alaska Show. Have a great week, everybody.